Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 239 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'm joined by co-host Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog.
Hi, 239?
It's kind of hard to believe. 239, this is the 239th episode, and there's no stopping us now, Rob.
I guess, and of course, milestones, and our guest is going to have one, too, that we can talk about a little later, but we'll save that.
Yes, we will. And David Vanderhoof is off again this week. Last week, David had some internet problems, and I forgot that he was going to be off again this week, and so I said that he would be joining us for sure. But David has I don't know what it is he's doing, Rob, but it was something that had been set up for some time, and so we'll miss David again 2 weeks in a row. This is getting difficult. All right. Well, our guest this episode is Bob Poole. He's the founder of the Reason Foundation. That's a free market think tank. They conduct public policy research. And Bob has been talking about the U.S. air traffic control system for quite a long time. Bob, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, guys. I'm really glad to be here this evening.
Now, you spent some time with us back in episode 95, almost 3 years ago.
We were just kids.
Just newbies getting started. So you've been involved with air traffic control at least that long, I guess. How long has it been?
Longer than that, actually. My first direct controller strike in 1981. I had a friend on the White House staff, and he knew I'd done a little writing about the subject for a book. And he asked me if I could come to Washington to advise them what to do. Managed to get a flight, even though there weren't very many, a briefing to the DOT Secretary, FAA Administrator, who was Lynn Helms at the time, about seeing if they could turn air traffic control into decision and rebuild it that way. And the DOT Secretary was interested. The FAA Administrator, Lynn Helms, said, absolutely not. If we have to do anything drastic, we're going to have the military take it over. So that was the end of that. California, and kind of forgot about it for a while. But I started really looking at air traffic control seriously and only started doing the newsletter that I do now every month. Started that 2001. So we just had issue number 100 last month.
Yeah, congratulations on that milestone. That's pretty good.
Very much.
Do you feel 100?
No, not at all. No, I'm still full of vim and vigor, and I still think this is an issue that really demands change. And I think, you know, maybe with the sequestration that is now upon us, that may be opening more eyes to the idea that the system is broken and needs to be changed.
Think about that. 30-something years screwing around with this. I mean, who'd have thought it would go this long?
Yeah, that is quite a long time. All right, well, we're going to talk some more about that, actually, in the news segment that's coming up. So we've got that, plus a few other stories to talk about. We've also got the Australia Desk report. Steve and Grant have pulled together some interesting news items from that region of the world, and so we'll have that coming up. And also Peter Johnson's Across the Pond segment. We've also got another listener recording or two, maybe even, telling the story of how they got interested in flying or developed a passion for aviation. We've got quite a number of stories that have come in, some listener recordings, and those are always amazing to listen to. So we have, again, one or two of those. We might even get to a few Grill the Geeks questions, Rob. We've had some come in. Even though it'll probably be just you and me at that point, we'll see if we can come up with some answers.
I was going to ask you about that because we haven't done any of those in a while, so I'm glad to hear that.
I know. Well, we've got a few in the kitty. We'll see what we can do. And we have a little bit of listener mail. We've got some of the listener mail that we received. We'll be able to talk about at the end of the show. First, though, let's get started with the aviation news. First item comes from an NTSB press release. This is NTSB releases interim factual report on JAL 787 battery fire investigation and announces forum and investigative briefing. Actually, an investigative hearing. And that's quite a mouthful. So the NTSB has, again, released this report. It's a 48-page report. It's a interim factual report, they call it. So it's recounting some of the facts. This is obviously concerning the JAL 787 fire in Boston previously. They talk about how the maintenance personnel discovered the fire, how the firefighters responded, some of the findings from the battery examination, test results of some of the components, flight data recorder results, some other things, and no real conclusions of any sort. So I guess, Rob, it's nice that they've sort of reiterated what's known to this point, but we don't have the kind of the big conclusion that we're always looking to the NTSB to provide.
Well, I think that if they had heard something really specific about the cause, we'd have heard about it. And so the fact that they had this all organized and reported and press released and everything else kind of made me kind of set me up for the fact that it wasn't going to say too much. But of course, I know Ray Conner said today that, you know, Boeing's CEO, that he says they're really close to coming up with a fix, although, you know, there are two different issues here. How do you fix it? But also the other question is, what was it that happened again? I mean, you know, what caused the problem initially? And so, you know, Boeing may have spent hundreds of thousands of man hours looking for a fix, but I'm still not completely sure they know what happened.
No, it doesn't seem that way. I mean, we know that Boeing has gone to Washington and proposed a solution. I've got air quotes around the solution. That hasn't been made public, although Boeing keeps saying that it's a permanent, not an interim solution. There's some speculation. We've talked about that previously, but we don't really know. We can't tell if Boeing knows. The NTSB doesn't seem to know.
Well, it could be one of those situations where they're just not giving us absolutely all the information because we're not asking the question the right way. Kind of like when Rand Paul did his filibuster last week. What he wanted to hear the attorney general say was, no, we will not target Americans with drones. And they kind of danced around the subject a little bit. And so, I mean, it could be one of those things, and maybe we'll find out. But I can't believe that Boeing could be close to believing that they have a permanent fix when there's so much at stake if they really weren't there. And again, my guess is that maybe they just aren't quite ready to release that yet. But I think, didn't those batteries come from Japan, I think? Wasn't that a piece of their manufacturing arm in Japan,
I think? Yeah, I think that was Yaesu produced those batteries. But, you know, there's a lot of folks involved. There's the battery producers and the controller producer. And, you know, there's a lot of components sort of in the chain. But, you know, that kind of the most interesting thing that I took away from this press release, is that there's going to be two events held in April that the NTSB is going to hold. There's a forum and there's an investigative hearing. And the forum is to explore lithium ion battery technology. And the investigative hearing, which is later in April, I suppose, that's supposed to focus on the design and certification of the 787 battery system. And these are, I think these are open forums. And in fact, both of them are going to be webcast live and open to the public. So that'll be kind of interesting, I guess. But it's two different topics, right? One is, let's talk about the battery technology and lithium ion batteries. And then let's talk about the process for designing and certifying new technology. Two different issues. But maybe that gives kind of a peek at what the NTSB is thinking about.
Oh, I think you're right. Yeah, I think you're right. And I think, too, that if people thought that bringing a new airplane to market was tough in the United States before the 787, I don't even want to think about what after this.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to our second story. This is from CNN. Towers can plead their case to remain open. This article says that the FAA is sending out letters to airports, mostly, I guess, small and medium-sized airports, and saying that the FAA may have to close their control towers because of budget cuts. I guess they're giving these airports an opportunity to make their case, as long as their case talks about how the national interest is harmed. And apparently the FAA is not interested in local impact. That doesn't count. Here comes sequestration again. But, you know, we can't stop talking about this. I know, Bob, you've been considering this in some of your writings recently.
Yeah, I mean, this is a problem that won't go away. And I also think that this is probably only the first of a whole series of budget cuts that we're going to be seeing over the next decade or so. Congress tries to grapple with getting back to the idea that every once in a while we really ought to run a balanced budget instead of trillion-dollar annual deficits.
Right.
Something's got to give.
You know, Bob, let me ask you a question. You know, I was out at an event in San Diego last week with a bunch of business aviation pilots, and we're going to talk about that later. But, I during the bit at the bar later when everybody had had a few beers and everybody was pretty loose, one of the guys and I started chatting, and we were talking about this issue, and he said, oh, you know, that is all just baloney. It's politics. It's all going to get fixed at the 11th hour. I'm just curious. I don't know. I have no insight here. Do you feel that from where you guys are planted, that this is just a big somebody yanking somebody else's chain?
Well, I think there's a lot of politicking going on in the way the administration's handling it. I mean, they clearly want to make the point, the House Republicans in particular, as the bad guys, and to say because they won't agree to another tax increase, therefore, everybody in the country is going to be suffering. You know, teachers are going to be laid off, police and firefighters. You know, President stood in the White House with police and firefighters. And then they put out all these things of air travel is going to have 90-minute delays at airports and so forth. I mean, clearly they're making a set of policy choices. It's a tough situation. We'll discuss that later, I imagine, what amounts to the cuts are being presented as 5%, but it's 5% applying to the second half of the fiscal year. So it's really 10% on an annual basis. That's not a trivial amount to cut out of budgets. I mean, there's a lot of posturing in Congress saying, oh, this is trivial, blah, blah, blah. Anybody can save 3 or 4%. But you're talking about in a six-month span cutting 10%. And that's not easy, not easy by any means, especially when the cuts have to go down at a pretty low level. It's not like a whole agency like the FAA could trade off anything that it does. So, I mean, I really think it's a real problem. It's not going to go away, and I doubt if there's going to be a pull a rabbit out of the hat fix at the end of the month to prevent at least some serious cuts from happening.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting to see how that goes down, because I believe that the begging and pleading is supposed to be finished up sometime this week. And one source I talked to said that we may know by the end of this week or very latest, the beginning of next week, about which towers may or may not be closed. So I guess it's going to be an interesting week.
I have, and particularly since most of the towers that are on the list are contract towers. I mean, you've got companies there that have to make decisions. What are they have to lay off everybody? Or most of their people, and they, you know, it's only good manners and good business practice to be able to give people at least some degree of notice of what's going to happen. So it's not fair to them to wait till the very last minute.
So that's interesting that you mentioned, contract towers, and if folks don't know, some towers are staffed by controllers that are not government employees or contractors, and others are staffed by FAA employees.
Right.
The contract employees, I mean, that's a lower cost method.
I mean, the Inspector General of the DOT just did a latest in a whole series of reports that go back over about 20 years and found that it costs about 25% as much, I kid you not, to operate a contract tower compared to a very similar FAA tower that has the same kind of non-radar, VFR type of operations and approximately the same traffic level. And that's an enormous difference. You could say that by closing down the contract towers, they're not saving anywhere near as much money as if they closed down some of their own.
Yeah, or, you know, and just from an outsider's perspective, and I know this is, I'm not saying this is a wise thing, but someone could ask the question, why not just reduce the number of FAA towers and make more use of contract labor?
That certainly would make the limited dollars go further.
It's sort of the question I would ask, I guess.
Well, yeah, and I think, too, of course, here in Chicago, we have a number of towers slated to shut. Two of them are contract. One is an FAA tower out at Chicago DuPage. And when this issue first came, I thought, oh, well, they're not going to just flat out close them. I said, maybe they're going to reduce the hours and maybe they're going to be open, you know, Monday through Friday, 8 to 6 or something. And they said, well, how do you know that? I said, well, I don't, but that would seem to make sense. And then someone went, yeah. and then, you know, somebody said, no, they're going to close the damn things down until the end of September. And I thought, holy smokes. If this really does happen, all they need is one deal. I'm sorry, that's air traffic controllers for our listeners. A deal where two of them get close.
Yeah.
You know, like one VFR guy departing off one runway and a jet coming off a crossing runway, and they don't know about each other for some reason. All they need is one really close one, or God forbid worse, and then it's really going to all hit the fan. And see, I didn't even have to use all the words, and everybody probably understood where I was going with that.
Yeah.
Now, Bob, one thing. Now, you were never a controller, were you?
No. I've been in a center one time. I've been in what used to be the Burbank Tracon one time before it was consolidated to Southern California Tracon. But I've never been a controller. I've never been a private pilot either. I have several friends who are private pilots. I've been up. I've done maneuvers in the air, coordinated turns and stall and recovery and that kind of thing, but never actually tried to get a license.
And you were so interested in this whole topic that the only thing you could do was start an organization to research could hang out with aviation people. I love
doing that. Yeah,
that's an airplane geek, Max. I've got to tell you.
Yeah.
Well, also, my dad was an engineer for Eastern Airlines, and so I grew up in an airline family.
Okay, there it is.
Was he on the Electras or anything like that? Or
no, he was not a flight engineer. He was a ground equipment engineer.
Ground support equipment.
Okay. Yeah. So we flew on passes, all the time when I was growing up. We had company passes, and that's how we went back and forth to college at MIT.
See, he was a geek. He's a geek at heart. You know, in fact, Bob, do you do any airplane geek pins, any buttons?
No, I haven't gotten into that.
Well, I don't even know if we had them then at episode 90.
No, that was well before we had buttons. Yeah.
Well, we've got to make sure we get your
I would love to have one.
But of course, what you have to do is you have to hang them from the sides of your glasses.
One on each side. How about from my pocket protector?
Yeah, well, there you go. On your fire. No, from an airplane geek.
All right, well, why don't we push on to another story we have here. And this one has been all over the news. We have an article from rawstory.com, a backlash from airline employees over move to allow knives on U.S. planes. Well, the TSA has made some changes to items permitted in carry-on luggage starting, I think, April 25th, 2013. And this affects knives and some sports equipment. And so why is the TSA doing this? Well, there is a couple of reasons. One is maybe if the agents are looking for fewer items, they don't need as many people at checkpoints. They've also mentioned that this brings the U.S. into alignment with international rules. Now, not everybody is real thrilled with this idea, but just so folks are sort of baselined on what this means, is that small knives will be permitted in carry-on luggage, but they have to meet some requirements. The blade can be no more than 2.36 inches, which sounds kind of funny, but that's 6 centimeters in length. That's maximum blade length, and the blade can't be any more than a half inch wide. Not permitted are knives with locking or fixed blades, knives with molded grips, and obviously razors and box cutters. So these are small knives, really small knives, little knives. But a lot of folks are upset. The Delta CEO is upset. The Flight Attendants Union Coalition is upset. The Coalition of Airline Pilots Associations is upset. everyone is a little kind of taken aback by this.
Well, you know, it was really, and I don't, I'm sorry, I don't mean to sound like I'm not, but what I thought was incredibly interesting was the response that the TSA sent out when this all hit the fan last week. John Pistol was the TSA administrator was at a security conference. That's when he announced this whole thing. And basically what he said was that the hardened cockpit doors have really, you know, done their job, and we don't have to worry about the cockpit crew essentially anymore. And then, when, you know, later on when this all hit the fan, the flight attendant said, yeah, but
what about us?
Yes, we're on the other side of the damn door. And so it's funny. I did not know that this rule existed in ICAO, which is the International Civil Aviation Organization, the sort of the United Nations body of that focuses on aviation up in Montreal. I did not know this existed, but I mean, I went out and bought one of these little knives just so I could see what it looked like, and it's amazing the carving job I could do on a watermelon. Not a watermelon, I mean, I'm sorry, you say a pumpkin. Just, and I'm cutting, I'm thinking, wow. If you think that one of these things in the hands of somebody that really wants to go after you is not dangerous, you are, you know, you're in serious need of some mental health work.
Rob, you don't carve watermelons for Halloween, do you?
Well, no. I'm trying to make a point, man, you know? Okay. No, I mean, but it is interesting just how much damage you could do with that small knife. I mean, if you took that knife and you just stood in front of a melon and went left to right as hard as you could across the front of the melon, you'd easily put a 2.5-inch cut right through that melon. And I got to tell you, I mean, I would not want to be the person with somebody holding that knife at my throat. And so I am amazed that we're not still talking about this in more detail at this point. But maybe there are things going on behind which we are not aware.
You know, I don't know. Almost anything can be turned into a weapon. You know,
right. I was going to say, I mean, you have in first class, which I get to fly once in a while on upgrades, you have metal forks like in the old days. You could do a lot of damage with a metal fork.
Yeah, sure.
You could do a lot of damage with a ballpoint pen, which I always have in my pocket. I mean, you know, you're talking about probably here the difference between amateurs and professionals. A professional killer doesn't need a knife.
That's true. That's very true.
Well, then, okay. And to make light of the there was a great comic. I'll see if I can get it. It was a great comic in today's Chicago Tribune that was making light of this whole thing, saying, you know, we can bring little knives on, but we can't bring a bottle of water, and we can't have shampoo, and we can't have, I forgot what else it was, but, you know, but knives are okay, and you're right, if it's a killer and they want you, I mean, you're right, a ballpoint pen could do it. I just think that this is probably such a tender subject, but the way it was handled, I mean, to say that it's okay, the pilots are fine because they're behind the locked door, and
right. That was not very good PR.
No, you're right.
But no, but this is really just going back. This was little knives. I always lived to fly with a small Swiss Army knife.
Sure.
Before 9/11, we all did.
Yeah.
Or many people did, and nobody thought anything of it. I mean, I think the flight attendants are really overreacting to this and not appreciating that if the point of the security measures is not to prevent anything at all from happening in the cabin, it's to prevent terrorists from taking over planes or blowing them up. And, you know, the TSA wants to focus on explosives primarily, explosives and guns. Make sure those don't go on the plane, and by simplifying the number of things they have to have their people paying attention to, they hope to get them more focused and also maybe to speed things up a little going through the checkpoint.
Which is a good thing, since a bunch of them are going to get laid off and slow down
right,
the line.
Right.
How come I don't believe that they're going to be moving any
the faster as a result. Yeah, I know. It seems kind of dubious.
But, no, I know.
But you know what I think is interesting is if you go up to the TSA website and to support your point, Bob, is that when you look at the number of firearms that they confiscate from people at the security, to this day,
I know, it's just amazing. Where these people are sleepwalking through life.
I know, and I know someone that, well, in fact, a couple of people that work for the TSA, and I say, are you guys just making this stuff up? And someone said, did you see the grenade? I said, you've got to be kidding me. He said, no, go up on the website this week. You know, and there's a grenade.
That's incredible.
I brought a grenade through security. Now, we're not talking about the fact that the guy was trying to take it and run for the gate. He just put it in his carry-on and said, they'll never notice that grenade. So it makes wonder about these people.
Yeah.
So some of the sports equipment that got swept into this into these changes are kind of interesting. You're going to be able to bring on board now pool cues, ski poles, that sounds like a weapon to me, or potential hockey sticks, lacrosse sticks, and now golf clubs, except for golf clubs, you're limited to two.
Well, how many rounds of golf play down the aisle?
I mean,
that's right. How many
only putters. Only putters.
Oh, yeah. That's right, because when you're stuck on the ground, you have nowhere to go. What else can you do but putter around, right?
Oh, bad. Yeah. No, but also, let me point out that, you know, okay, ski pole maybe is a weapon potential, but so knitting needles have been allowed for years.
Right.
Knitting needles are a weapon.
And they can be. But
they certainly can be.
But knitters are feisty.
Easier than a ballpoint pen.
Yeah, if you rile up the knitters, there's millions and millions of them. And I love them dearly, and I spend actually a lot of time with quite a few of them. But you get them angry, and boy, it's watch out. So we can close out this maybe with final article on this, which we'll put a link in the show notes. But you know, the Onion.com, and when they see something ridiculous, they run with it. So they've got a news story out on this topic. I'll just tell you what the title is. And again, this is about the little knives. The Onion article is titled "TSA to Allow Small Terrorists on Planes."
Oh, God.
We love those
all
guys.
Right.
All right. So, Rob, a final news item. You were at the NBAA International Operators Conference last week. How did that go?
It was quite interesting. I wouldn't say it was exciting, because no one goes to a conference where people talk about international aircraft operating procedures and said, wow, it was just tantalizing. But it's very interesting. When I think this is probably the seventh or eighth year that I've been to these things, and to watch the transition from the way that they handled international procedures, you know, sort of right after 2011 or 2001, and even air traffic control, up to where they are today with ADS-B going in so many places, and ADS-C, and I won't go into all the bits and pieces, but let's just say it's more and more automation that's going to allow aircraft to fly much closer together over oceanic airspace, and you know, really increase the capacity for air traffic. It's just amazing. And then when you look at the technology inside the airplanes, and also, as I said, at the controller stations for oceanic and domestic controllers in Europe and Australia and Asia, and it's just fascinating. And then, of course, the job of NBAA at the IOC is to help crews figure out the best way to make all this stuff kind of come together, not just air traffic wise, but also with how to get permits to fly into and out of certain countries, and all the immigration and topics that need to be dealt with, passenger information and all that sort of thing, so they can get in and out without being stopped at the gate, and just, you know, probably 15 other topics. And so by the time I left, it was sort of coming out of my ears, but it's just such almost a fire hose of information that helps people fly business jets out of the U.S. to destinations all over the world, and they are going absolutely almost anywhere these days. It's amazing how little publicity we really see about business aviation and how it's really used. I mean, I know we get the certain president I know that's in Washington right now that's from the same state I am, who shall go nameless, who thinks that every time you mention a business jet, you've got to talk about fat cats
and billionaires.
Mm-hmm. And I wish he could have been there to watch the sort of the business in motion and the international corporations that could not explore the new territories and opportunities that they do without the airplanes that they have. And I didn't see this particular unnamed president, though, at the event. So I'm going to assume maybe he'll read one of my stories about it or something.
One can only hope.
Yes.
Was there an interesting keynote speaker or any other interesting folks there that you heard?
Well, there was actually a fellow at luncheon was his name was Wahid Faris, and he's a an international consultant on I guess I would say security. And what was interesting about it is that he gave everybody a chance to look at how people outside the United States view the United States and our security policies all over the world. He's Lebanese by birth, and so he comes at this from a very different perspective than we do. And he's a consultant with the Department of Defense and the Justice Department and some organizations in Europe and in Asia, and very interesting speaker. And again, I mean, I think he had everybody pretty well spellbound while he explained the difference between how we think people see us and his explanation of how they really see us and where the policies the U.S. government has are headed and where they're not headed. So that's the one that kind of jumps out at me, though. Although I do have to say one nice point, one lady that has from NBAA that has been there for a long time, Sandy Wirtz, who is the lady from the National Business Aviation Association that was the sort of the goddess of the International Operators Conference and helped organize them year after year, retired this year, so they had a nice party for her. And during the party for her, they had two people come out. One was a U.S. Navy pilot, the other a U.S. Air Force pilot. And it turns out that one was the flight leader for the Thunderbirds, and the other one was the flight leader from the Blue Angels.
Oh, wow.
And they told us all kinds of inside stories, none of which I can repeat, unfortunately, because they swarmed to secrecy. And they said, if anybody finds out, they said they both pointed at me and they said, we're coming after you. It's really a good time, and it was amazing what those guys do to support the essence of aviation around the world. And wasn't it ironic that they were giving these talks as we're talking about all these shows being canceled, which everybody was kind of heartbroken about. But we don't have David on this week to really get into that.
Bob, is there a sort of similar flocking of air traffic control professionals?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, last month I was in Madrid with 5,000 air traffic control professionals for the World ATM Air Traffic Management Congress that was sponsored by CANSO, which is the organization for air navigation service providers all over the world. They have about 75, including the FAA's Air Traffic Organization, as members. And they were the host organization, and there was a massive exhibition hall with Lockheed Martin and Honeywell and Raytheon and all these companies, plus about a dozen of the air navigation service providers themselves, like Nav Canada, many of which sell services to other providers, and so they had booths as well, displaying some of the things they're doing. So it was a very exciting time, very expensive too, despite the, I think they were taking advantage of having a lot of foreign visitors in Spain to, the taxi drivers were ripping us off like mad.
But is that Madrid airport not the most massive thing you've ever seen in your life?
It is huge. It's the third time I've been there in the last decade. It is huge. Very, very nice looking. It's probably way more than they need, in my candid opinion, but it'll certainly serve their needs for a long time.
Oh, my Lord. I came out of Paris a few months ago, and they routed me through Madrid, and I had never been there. And they said, oh, well, you know, I forgot what airline I was on. And they said, well, you're coming into this terminal and you're going out on that one over there. And I went, okay, that's great. And then I walked in and I thought, oh, my God, this is the biggest terminal I've ever seen. And the lady said, oh, no, this is just one of, I don't know, what is it, one of three or one of four?
Yeah, the three or four, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, who in God's name paid for this?
Yeah, I wonder.
Oh, Lord. But I know their traffic is way down, too. So maybe that's why they have them out there.
Now, Bob, as we record this, in a few days, there's a conference in Amsterdam, right? ATC Global 2013.
That's right.
You are going to have a paper delivered there by someone else, I think.
Correct. That's right. A colleague, a friend of mine in London is going to be delivering the paper. Both conferences invited me to speak, and I just couldn't afford the time to go to both of them. So I know more of the people at Canso, and I decided that theirs was the one I would choose. But this other one, they're hoping to be equally as big, and the one in Amsterdam has been going on every year for, I think, 15 years.
Hey, can you give us a little summary of the presentation?
It's going to be, it's actually an adaptation of something from my newsletter an issue or two ago, talking about what terminology should we use about air traffic control reform. And I say we shouldn't call it privatization because in most cases it isn't. And that just stirs up a lot of fear and hostility from people who aren't sure what that would mean, and they think it would mean everybody gets fired and new people come in and take over and so forth and so on. So I thought that was a useful thing for people to hear. It's a message I've been trying to get across to the growing number of people that I've gotten to know at the Controllers Union in this country, NATCA, who will obviously be a key player if we do make a big change in how air traffic control is provided here.
Well, do you see the role of, not the role, but the evolution of NAV Canada as a good example of how things could evolve?
Yes. To put it simply, I do. I think actually NAV Canada is one of the most, if not the most successful of the what we call commercialized or corporatized air traffic providers in the world. Just today, in the mail today, I got the 2012 annual report from NAV Canada, and they are just doing great. They have an investment-grade bond rating from all three rating agencies. This last year was their eighth year in a row without a rate increase because they continue to be efficient and use technology and smarter procedures and so forth. They're the leading air navigation provider in going to space-based ADS-B. They're taking actually an investment position in the Iridium company that is going to be called Aireon, actually started using the Iridium to provide global ADS-B for polar regions and so forth. I mean, they're a first-rate organization, and the entire aviation community, as far as I can tell, in Canada, is very pleased with the way things have turned out. Canadian Business Aircraft Association is represented on NAV Canada's board, along with airlines and controllers. I think it's a very smart way to organize.
Bob, what makes them so good at doing this?
Well, one of the things that they've done is they've really engaged serious engineers and software people, in addition to controllers and technicians and so forth on their staff. They actually develop a lot of technology in-house. I have not actually been there, but I've talked to people who've gone and visited, U.S. visitors have gone and spent a day being shown around, talking to the people who actually develop new technology. I just dazzled that, and this includes, I had lunch a few months ago in Washington with a senior guy at NATCA headquarters, our controllers union. He'd visited NAV Canada and talked to their employees, the controllers, is they think they have done very well as employees at NAV Canada, and their jobs are very fulfilling. They don't have the kind of friction. Certainly, they have negotiations over salaries, like any union would, of course, but they don't have the same kind of long-standing friction that has existed between controllers and management and the FAA, and something very much to NAV Canada's credit.
Interesting.
And I think one other thing that you touched on briefly is the technology. They actually develop products that they're selling to other countries.
That's right. That's why they had a big booth at that conference in Madrid.
Yeah. I thought that was real. I met some of those folks last year. No, I think it was the year before at the International Operators Conference. And when they told me they were, I said, you have to be. I didn't realize right. how much I had really missed. And I looked at this and I thought, wow. And then, of course, I talked to some folks from NATCA here. And to be fair to the NATCA folks, even if the Controllers Union folks liked what they saw at NAV Canada, they're not going to say that publicly.
And they're probably not going to say it publicly, but I think that's an important sign, though, that says that if we do get a change the way the U.S. Air Traffic Organization is structured and governed and funded, not clear to me that NATCA would necessarily oppose it. In fact, when the Clinton administration, back in 1994, inventing government shop originally, and then was studied in detail by the Secretary of Transportation, Federico Pena, they proposed a U.S. Air Traffic Services Corporation. It was called USATS. They introduced legislation, and it would have been like NAV Canada. It would have been self-funded, so that the money wouldn't be controlled by Congress any longer. It would go, fees would be paid directly to the air traffic company, and it could issue bonds in the bond market to pay for big costly things, but it got nowhere in Congress at that time in 1994. But NATCA supported it. That was my point.
Yeah.
NATCA actually supported that reform, because they at the time thought things couldn't be any worse than they were with the FAA as it was, and that they thought they would have a better shot at a good working environment and more progress and so forth under that kind of arrangement.
Well, we proved that wrong, didn't we?
I think the key, the lesson that what I wrote in my air traffic newsletter last month was that the sequester and the likely future sequesters cannot happen in Canada, does not happen or cannot happen in the UK or Spain or Australia or New Zealand. All of those governments, all those countries have removed their air traffic tickets, meaning removing it from the government's budget and the elected representatives' ability to say this gets funded and that doesn't, and insulated it from anything like sequesters or across-the-board budget cuts, because it's self-funded like a utility. You and I pay our electric bills. We pay for the services we get. It means that thing is financially independent of the government. Most of these are government corporations. NAV Canada is private nonprofit, but most, the one in Germany, the one in Australia, the one in New Zealand, the one in Switzerland, these are almost all government corporations, but they're financially self-supporting. That makes a huge difference.
And I know we've got to move on, but I just wanted to add one point, is that when I have spoken to ATC folks here in the States years ago, they used to say, oh, well, that's a lot of baloney. I mean, that's a very small system. It would never. Well, I mean, you've probably
heard, right,
the same
heard that all the time.
And I said this to somebody not long ago, and I said, yeah, but now when you look at how well the NAV Canada operation seems to run and how relatively happy the people seem to be to work there, and the fact that they're reaching out and actually producing products that they're selling that are, helping them make the bottom line, don't you think at least worth exploring to see if there couldn't be availability to bring that to the United States? And I've heard people say, because I think anybody with their head screwed on straight has got to look at that and say, that has got to be the chaos that we're dealing with right now. And to your point of, years ago, them saying it couldn't get any worse. Well, it did.
It did. That's right. It is worse, and it's likely to continue being worse because, as I said, I mean, we're a long, long way from a balanced budget. And people, when Paul Ryan, the House Budget Committee chair, says he's now going to be releasing a 10-year plan, a 10-year budget that would get to a balanced budget after 10 years, that's being denounced as will be denounced as radical and ridiculous, and there's no way that could possibly happen. 10 years, and you know, so we'll see if the Senate comes up with anything that produces a balanced budget in 20 years. But I think the idea that the government is going to have the money to do all the things that we want to do is just not realistic. And aviation, like everything else, is in for as far as we can see into the future, very difficult financial times unless we can figure out a smarter model for how to fund it and run it.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, is the government going to do that for us, or does the industry need to go to the government with, you know, the
I think
the
it's going to have, this is not going to come, it's certainly not going to originate from Congress, and I doubt if it's going to come from at least this administration. It's going to have to come from the industry. If the aviation community gets together, which is what happened in Canada, that's how NAV Canada got created. The aviation industry itself got together and researched it, came up with a proposal, and got good support in the media, and it became something that Parliament was sort of pushed into enacting. And I think something like that is the path forward. We have to come up with a way that makes this in the interest of all of aviation, including general aviation, including AOPA, you know, the small planes, as well as NBAA, but also in the interest of NACA and the other unions. I think a win-win possibility does exist for doing this, because we've seen it happen in country after country.
Right. Yeah. It's just a matter of some strong force pulling it all together and you know, getting everybody in the industry, in all aspects of the industry,
right,
sort of marching
right
together.
I think what we have right now is a burning platform, meaning the money is burning, and we're going to be in really difficult straits.
Well, Bob, before we let you go, let's talk a little bit about the Reason Foundation. This is it's a nonprofit organization, so you're funded by contributions from.
That's right. It's about 90% or about 85% individual contributions of all sizes from all over the country, about another 10% from foundation grants, and about 5% from corporate contributions. So, and the budget is I think $9 million this year. Is about 60 employees. And we're nonprofit tax exempt, so the contributions people make are tax deductible.
Now, you've mentioned your newsletter. I know I subscribe to your, I think it's the Airport Policy and Security News. Is that right?
Right. So there's two newsletters on aviation. One is the Airport Policy newsletter that includes security. The other is ATC Reform News, which is the one that just had its issue number 100 last month. And so they're both available at no charge. All people have to do is send me an email, bob.poole@reason.org, or they can go to the website, reason.org, and look for newsletters, and you can sign up there as well.
And you have some videos on. I just discovered that recently.
Yes. Reason.tv is the video division, and we've had several videos, including one that talked about how the Clinton administration tried to reform air traffic control and how NAV Canada did it and puts us to shame. So we try to use the video as another communications tool, and a lot of them get massive. Most of them ended up on YouTube and get huge numbers of downloads.
Yeah, very good.
Can I just ask one question, Bob?
Yes, sir.
In your travels, I mean, when you interact with all the people you do all over the world, do you ever find people that are, you know, like unreasonable?
There's lots of unreasonable people, that's for sure.
And how do you handle that?
Well, I try not to be that confrontational. I recognize you're not going to persuade everybody, and sometimes it's better just to you know, say, well, okay, sorry, I guess we have to agree to disagree.
That's the trick. So I just wondered if that had ever happened to you, and I just
yes, indeed,
sage advice. And honestly, I hope that someday we obviously it won't be as long next time before we have you on again. I'd really like to get some of the other bright people in the air traffic control world on to talk about this topic of of Nav Canada or
you might want to get somebody from Nav Canada on. I know a number of people there and could try to put you in touch with one or two of them.
That would be really neat. We'd like to do that. I mean, I don't think we'll get the NATCA people on. They always say no.
That's too bad.
Yeah, but then that's the way it goes.
Yep.
But,
all right. Well, Bob, very good. Thanks for joining us.
I had a great time. It's really fun talking aviation with aviation people. So thanks for having me on.
So just one last thing, Bob. So if people want more information, the place they should go is reason.org.
That's right.
All right. Thanks again. All right, so now what we've got is Steve and Grant from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast with their Australia Desk Report.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 11th of March, 2013.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome back to the Australia Desk for episode 239. And Grant, well, here we are back in studio land again after a wonderful week at Avalon, and I think my sunburn is just about faded now.
Mate, I don't know, you're still sort of giving off that low infrared glow.
Well, now we've missed a few stories during the week in normal aviation news while we were at Avalon, but I guess probably the saddest story that came out during that period was the death of former Qantas and Australian Airlines boss James Strong, a very well-known figure in the Australian aviation industry. And Grant, he died too young at age 68.
He certainly managed to pack a lot into that 68 years, mate. He was quoted a number of times as saying that he didn't want to get to the end of his life and go, hang on, I don't think I've really participated.
Well, participate he certainly did. Now, of course, he was the chief executive and managing director of Qantas from 1993 until 2001. And prior to that, he was actually in the same position in Australian Airlines, formerly TAA. And as some of our listeners may well be aware, Australian Airlines was eventually taken over by, merged into Qantas. back in the early 1990s. And James Strong was always known for wearing very interesting bow ties. But interestingly, Grant, after he left the aviation industry, he was active in a number of other companies, very well-known companies in this country, including Woolworths, which is a big supermarket company here, Rip Curl, a big surfwear company, an insurance group, Kathmandu, and many, many others, and was also well-known as a great contributor to and patron of the arts. So James Strong, I guess a controversial figure, in some ways, but very well known in the aviation industry, and it's a little bit less for losing him.
That's right, mate. They have some reference to the fact that, especially when he was with TAA and then later with the Qantas world, whenever he travelled, he would always be keen to chat with the people. And it has been commented that things were never quite the same without him when a number of CEOs would really not want to deal with the frontline staff.
Now, moving on here, Grant, some frustrating news, I guess, for Virgin. Now, we've been talking over the last several Ausdesks about their bid to take over Tiger Airways, or at least take a very big stake in them. The Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, who should have made a decision on that by now, has decided that it needs a little bit more time. It wants a little bit more information. And listening to some radio interviews this week, I get the impression that John Borghetti, the boss of Virgin Australia, is getting a little impatient about that.
No, I don't blame him at all, mate. They're trying to take 60% stake in Tiger Airways. It was supposed to have been a decision earlier this year. Then it was going to have been a decision right about now, as this is coming out. And the latest word is the ACCC is pushing this back to whenever. They're not really saying. They want to get more and more and more information. And it's got to be getting frustrating for folks. Borghetti has said he's not going to pursue Tiger at any cost. He's going to make sure that it's a good deal if it happens at all. So there is potential here that if the ACCC puts too many conditions and requirements on, that Borghetti and co. will just walk. Meanwhile, it's making it rather hard for Virgin and Tiger to get on with their planning and make things happen.
Interestingly here, Grant, he's saying here that he wants to increase the Tiger Airways fleet to 35 aircraft. Now, I think they've only got 10, maybe 11 aircraft at the moment, all A320s. So I think with 35 aircraft in the fleet over time, that would certainly make it a much more viable competitor for, I guess, Jetstar. It's interesting that the ACCC has got brakes on this. I mean, the Qantas Group is effectively structured similarly, with Jetstar being the budget brand and Qantas Qantas mainline being the premium brand. You know, with this deal, it would make Virgin Australia the premium brand of that group and Tiger Airways the budget brand. So,
well, they're trying to say that they're scared that it'll bring it down to a two airline kind of environment. Even though you'll have different brands, it'll effectively be run by two organizations. And that's what's giving them the problem. But meanwhile, they're busy saying, yes, it's all looking good for Qantas and Emirates with their Trans-Tasman alliance. As you know, we've got Qantas and Emirates joining up to form QFEK, as everyone's calling it. But because both airlines send aircraft across the Tasman to New Zealand, there is some concern that they'll pull back on services and just work together to really blitz the environment. And the ACCC is saying, no, you're going to be okay so long as you don't change your number of flights. Don't go below a minimum level of capacity and all will be well. So interesting that they're going ahead on that one. Admittedly, there are a number of airlines that cross the Tasman, but it's a shame that they're holding out on Virgin's bid for Tiger, that's for sure.
Yes, and as I've long said, I think that they would probably improve Tiger Airways. It wouldn't take that much. Anyway, Grant, let's move on before I get myself in trouble again with the listeners.
Well, mate, they may accuse you of droning on that subject with Tiger.
Yeah, I could drone on about that, but let's drone on about this. The Civil Aviation Safety Authority is proposing to regulate unmanned aerial vehicles on a weight-based system, which the operators of the smallest drones will be able to get approval online, according to an article this week in theaustralian.com.au. Very interesting stuff.
Oh, weight as in kilos, not weight as in hours.
Yes, weight as in kilos. And that's very interesting. Of course, there's so many different types of unmanned aerial vehicles around. I remember at our Christmas do a year or so back, Grant, we were looking at some of these very small camera-carrying platforms called octocopters or hexacopters or something. And even CASA, I think, had to have a bit of a role in regulating those. And, of course, then we move right up to the more large-scale military ones and the civilian variants that are starting to come to market these days. So a lot of people have qualms about it, but, you know, it's technology, it's inevitable, and, you know, CASA, along with all similar groups around the world, really has to move to make sure they keep up with it.
Well, it's that technology issue that's making them go into this structured approach to drones in terms of weight, because things are innovating so quickly in the area that if they get specific about it, it's going to be out of date by the time it gets signed into law.
CASA Director John McCormick Grant, who you met recently and interviewed, told an industry group this week at a conference in Melbourne that the number of holders of UAV operator certificates had doubled from 15 to 30 in the past year, and it was expected to double again in the next year. Now, of course, you know, to our American audience, that doesn't sound like much, but here in Australia, where the population is slightly smaller, that's actually an interesting number, and it would be interesting, Grant, to get a breakdown of some of the sizes of that fleet.
Indeed, because a number of them are very probably going to be hexacopters and octocopters or even quadricopters. But for all that, there's probably going to be a few larger ones floating around out there as well, especially on pipeline duties and so on, the more autonomous drones as opposed to the line of sight ones and or the operator with a remote control rig.
Interestingly, what they're saying here is that potentially the very lightweight ones can apply for a permit online and expedite that process. And I imagine for some of the, you know, we've seen these carrying predominantly cameras around doing things like television commercials and sporting matches and all that sort of stuff. Well, you know, it's a good idea actually to change the civil aviation safety regulations. They're talking about part 102 here to accommodate that, because as I say, there's going to be more and more of them around. And I tell you what, speaking of a sector where I think unmanned planes will eventually come first, let's talk about freighters.
Oh, I just heard a million freight dogs scream out in anger.
Yeah, well, I don't blame them either.
I think they'd actually be quite happy about Qantas considering buying some more freighters.
Well, you know, actually, I think if large-scale unmanned airline operations ever came to pass, and let's hope that doesn't happen in my lifetime, but if it did, I reckon freighters is where they'd probably start it. Much more easy for the public to get used to it, I think. But yeah, Qantas is looking at buying some more. They've already got a handful of freighters, including a bunch of 737s and a 767, and they've been using, I think it's Atlas Air, is it, Grant, to do a lot of their other freight work, but they're looking at expanding that.
Yeah, we'll see how this one goes. Atlas Air are currently being leased by Qantas to provide heavy lift freight performance. With them considering buying a set of 747-400s, pay a little bit extra for the fuel, but at least for the next 3 to 5 years, that'd probably work out quite well.
Yeah, and it's actually making them a little bit of money, the freight business for Qantas, so that's a very positive thing. And I suppose they can afford to buy those aircraft, Grant, because just looking here in the first 6 months of this financial year, they've actually made a profit, and it's risen to $111 million, up from $42 million from the same period last year.
That's right, mate, and a big factor in that has been two unusual, unexpected incomes, shall we say. One is about $30 million from selling their share of a road freight company. The other unexpected income has been from Boeing. When Boeing were trying to get Qantas to sign on for the 787, I've got to say Qantas were very canny. They did some amazing deal making and set things up such that if Boeing were continuously running late and Qantas decided to let it go, Boeing would give them a big fat amount of money. And you know, I think I've heard that that was actually about $125 million of compensation they got from Boeing. Not bad.
So like you say, Grant, without even putting a single airframe into service, the 787 Dreamliner is already making Qantas money. So I think I have to reevaluate all those nasty things I've said about the Qantas board and their financial management over the last few years. Interestingly, I heard John Borghetti, the boss of Virgin, this week on radio, saying that they are evaluating the 787 as well, along with the A350X. So well, there you go. Interesting stuff. I like the Airbus, Grant. In fact, I like that nice grey one I flew in the other week. I think that was an A330 with some modifications. What a fantastic machine. Very comfortable ride.
Well, mate, the only good thing about your KC-30 ride is that you're no longer talking about the C-130 ride.
You know what I'm working on now, mate, is a C-17 ride.
Well, Eamon's your man, and I think that small packet of non-sequential unmarked bills that you handed him on the back of his golf cart last AusDesk could have something to do with it.
No, it was just three boxes of Tim Tam, mate. Works a charm. Tim Tam, works a charm.
The new currency for bribery, huh?
Absolutely. Well, I think we'll leave it there for this week. Until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm still the jealous Grant McCarran.
All right. You know, Rob, I'm still trying to get caught up on all of their reports from the Avalon show. They've really scored a lot of fantastic interviews. I have a lot of episodes of Plane Crazy Down Under out with those interviews that are really worth listening to.
Did you ever listen to how quickly Steve Vischer speaks? I would like to go back and listen to the first one or two episodes. We ought to do that sometime. Just go back and play some clips from the first ones and then listen to them now, because they have really evolved. Seriously. I mean, it's really gratifying to know that those guys have just kicked our butts in terms of some of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But
you go back and listen to some of our early episodes and they're not very impressive. Anyway, another impressive guy is Peter Johnson. And he's got his Across the Pond segment. Here's Peter.
On our final segment on the Southampton mini-series, we return to the airport to talk to Vicky Parks, who's a marketing manager for the airport. So, Vicky, welcome to Across the Pond.
Thank you very much for having me.
Vicky, the airport's got a blog, a YouTube channel, and is active on Twitter and a Facebook page. What's your objective here?
The main objective is to increase engagement with our passengers and also the local community. So we like to interact with them, ask some questions, find out what they like about the airport and how they find their journey through the airport.
Right.
We can also do quite a lot of engagement with where they'd like to fly to, so we can ask them questions, and which helps our business going forward. But the main objective is to get some news offers out to our regular customers to make sure that they're fully up to date with what's going on in the airport.
So why the communities?
We like to speak to people in the community, mainly through Facebook, so that they know exactly what's going on within the airport. We also have opportunities for local charities, and we like to promote those through Facebook and also Twitter.
Okay. And do you support local charities?
We do support local charities, yes. So each year we do give money to local charities who have to bid for it.
Right.
And then we work with them afterwards to on their charity projects.
Okay. And who are your target audiences with all these mediums? And how do you know which is the best one to use for each of the audience profiles?
All platforms that we use through social media are different, so not all messages are completely appropriate. We use Twitter mainly as a customer service function, and also when there's weather disruption to make sure that everyone gets updated.
Yeah.
Facebook is more of an engagement tool, so it includes things like competitions and fun questionnaires and surveys. Our blog is for inbound passengers to tell them how amazing it is to come down to Hampshire, look at all the local attractions. We also have some really good blogs on travel experiences, also some general aviation blogs as well, so that it details exactly what happens when there's things like snow or fog and why the disruption happens.
Right. Okay. And then just moving on from that then, and given the mixed audiences that you have, how do you know what the right content is to produce? And there's always a risk with maybe selling too much and turning people off.
We try to use social media as an engagement tool rather than a commercial selling tool. So we try to limit commercial messages down to 20% or less.
Right, okay.
We want people to come in and see what the essence of the airport is all about and what our brand is all about, rather than trying to sell them things along the way. Each marketing platform that we use through social media depends on the message that we're putting out. So as I said before, if it's a customer service feedback or message to go out, we would tend to use Twitter. Right. It's very much an instant feedback tool, so it means that we can get the information out fairly quickly. So in terms of disruption when it snows, we can update passengers as and when the information comes into us. With Facebook, again, it's very much a fun and friendly place to be. We give prizes out and make sure that people are engaging with us, asking them lots of questions, where they'd like to fly to, is there any destinations we currently don't have that they'd like. So messages on there tend to be a lot less commercial and a lot less customer service focused. And then we've got our blog, which again is more about travel advice, where to go in the Hampshire area, where to go when we go to our destinations, and focuses on things like St. Patrick's Day in Dublin, going to Paris for Valentine's Day, and looks at that side of the kind of weekend away traffic.
Right, okay. And what sort of feedback do you get through these mechanisms? Are you able to monitor how your recipients are receiving the messages, or are they passive?
We've actually just launched a new system last week, which makes us able to monitor every single thing that happens on Facebook and Twitter. It's a social media management platform that allows us to see if each and every message that we receive is a positive or negative. So it flashes up if it's a negative, so we can then go in and action it. So for example, if we get a negative, any negative feedback on Twitter, we will know immediately, and we can go in and actually try and deal with that customer. And we try and do that while the customer's still in the airport, so try and track them down, try and solve it so that they don't leave the airport on a kind of negative note. Most of the feedback that we get through Twitter is actually positive, especially through the snow. We had a huge amount of thank yous from passengers saying thank you for updating us, who were sitting in the terminal not really understanding what was going on at that point. And Facebook, again, we don't get a huge amount of negative comments on there. Mainly it's just fun and friendly. We try and kick off some debates here and there, but we really just look at as it comes in.
Okay, and your Twitter feed's pretty active. It's quite useful. I've been through the airport and used it several times. Do you think that people do get turned off if you try to sell for them to them over those sorts of mediums?
Absolutely. I think the social media aspect of our marketing plan is not hugely about the commercial side. Again, customer service is top of our main priority when it comes to Twitter. We try not to sell things on there. We have email marketing and Breeze Magazine to do that function for us. So we avoid it if we can. But like I say, any commercial messages, we try and keep to at least under 20%.
What's exciting on the various mediums at the moment? What's an active topic that some of the listeners can go and pick up on your Facebook page, or maybe look at on your blog?
At the moment, we've got some excellent competitions going on Facebook. Currently, you can win flights to Barcelona. We also have lots of debates, like I said. So we put things on there, like AirAsia launching and child-free section of their aeroplanes, just to see kind of how people feel about it, really.
Right.
My personal favourites of the blog currently are the snow blog and the fog blog, which just really details how an airport can function in that situation and why the disruption happens. And I think it's just really nice for customers to be able to understand it slightly more, so they don't sit here wondering what's going on.
Right. Vicky, thanks so much for joining us. Can you just remind us how we can engage with Southampton Airport then?
Yes. If you go onto our website, you can link through to Facebook, Twitter, and you can also have a look at our YouTube channel and our blog. Our website address is www.southamptonairport.co.uk.
Vicky, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
Gee, Southampton Airport, that's a pretty hip airport, I'd say.
Yeah, and whoever thought of calling an airport hip?
Well, I think these guys come close.
It's not something you think about.
Yeah.
But I think that's pretty cool that that Peter's finding all these people, too. I wonder how he gets all these interviews.
We'll have to ask him.
Well, he would probably never divulge his secret, because eventually, you know, he's going to go the way of those guys down in Australia, you know, where they talk to us occasionally and they kind of give us the time of day. But
every now and then.
They forget where they started, I think, don't they?
Well, you know that fire truck, that airport truck
cool.
that we lusted after last week? Yeah. Peter sent along some additional information on that. Did you?
I did. I saw that.
Did you see what that thing costs?
Well, I know I'm not going to be buying any.
$500,000 a piece. It's a Rosenbauer Panther 6x6 fire truck. And Peter said that it's from memory, but he thinks it gets about a mile to the gallon. Boy. Rob, if you had an extra $500,000 burning a hole in your pocket, would you buy one of those fire trucks or would you buy an airplane?
I think I would probably make better use of the airplane. Think about this. You know what the real problem with that fire truck is? Yeah. I mean, if you had one, where do you park it?
Oh, anywhere you want. Anywhere you want.
Dear, is that a fire truck sitting on top of our car?
That's right. Oh, but you think of the fun you could have.
Those machines are incredibly expensive. In fact, we do some work with the guys up at Oshkosh, and Oshkosh vehicles are made right on the other side of the airport. And when you look at the size of the vehicles, the fire trucks, the snow blowers, the sweepers, they're even more. I've seen some that were in the $600,000 to $700,000 category.
Wow.
And it's for one truck. And of course they last, I don't know, 10 to 15 years is kind of the useful life. It's a pretty heavy duty capital expenditure for an airport.
Yeah, it sure is. I think Peter sent along a couple of links to this, or at least one link to some more information about this fire truck. So we'll put that in the show notes. I think they said it's got a planned lifetime of 20 years, if I remember right, but it's cool. I'd love to have one of those in my backyard.
Oh, we got to go for a ride in one of those. Yeah. It is so cool.
Yeah. You just think you could drive up to your neighbors and, do donuts in their backyard. And when they came out screaming at you, you could shoot them with a foam cannon. I think it'd be a blast.
Wow. That would that would give them that. They would respect you at that point.
They wouldn't have any choice. That's right.
Hey, I know we're kind of, feeling a little lonely here without David, but we're not going to do anything really special tonight or anything, that we haven't done in a while, hint, hint, or anything. Are we, Max?
Yeah, we have gotten a few Gorilla Geeks questions.
Oh, but David's not here, so I guess we can save them for next time.
Ah, well, that's true. It's not the same without David. But all right, let's do one. This came in from John Arvin. And actually, I think you already answered this last week, but here's the question. Why does Airbus call its winglets sharklets? Now, we were talking about winglets and sharklets. So John says, why does Airbus call its winglets sharklets?
You wanted me to tell you. I mean,
yeah, that's the idea.
You mean right now?
Right now.
Okay, John. I have no idea why they call them. It must have something to do with the way they stick up in the air, the way a shark's vertical fin sticks up on the shark in the water. I guess I'm guessing, but that's kind of where I'd be.
You're overthinking it.
Okay. Looks like a shark.
No.
Swims like a shark.
It's because it's
painted like a shark.
I think what John was getting at was that it's because of the patent dispute between Airbus and Boeing and aviation partners along with Boeing. John sent along some articles. One is from the Wall Street Journal. This is almost a year ago, March in 2012. And another one this is from Aviation Week in 2013, and this is some interesting stuff. It says that apparently Airbus talked with Aviation Partners, who we mentioned last time is the producer of these things, and it's that company, Aviation Partners, is in a partnership or a joint venture or something with Boeing. But Airbus talked with Aviation Partners about 5 years ago about possibly using a design from them for its winglets. And in fact, there was actually a memorandum of understanding in 2011 to form a joint venture. But at the same time, Airbus also kept working on its own version of that. So apparently Airbus last summer, in which would have been 2012, showed Aviation Partners their drawings. And Aviation Partners said that they are now too close to their technology and they wanted royalties. So there's some kind of a legal action. And I'm not exactly sure what the status of that is. Hey, Airbus is saying, I guess, hey, these are sharklets. And Aviation Partners saying, no, those are winglets, which we have patents on. But, you know, when you look into this, there's some really interesting stuff going on. There's all these patents out there now for these things. I mean, who knew that there was so much aerodynamics associated with wingtips? There's patents with hoops, with curls, you know, kind of, you know, very odd shaped, you know, wingtips. There's even some patents out there, or at least a patent out there, for a winglet that's got actively controlled surfaces on it. So there's all this stuff going on. You know, it'll be interesting to see where the technology goes and who comes out with what in the future. But as it is now, we have winglets on Boeings and sharklets on Airbus.
And so the answer to John's question was what exactly?
I've forgotten after all that. No, I think because of the patent dispute.
Oh, they had to call it something else.
They had to call it something else.
Okay, all right.
All right, so.
I buy that.
So, thanks,
John.
John, for saying
that. I told you we knew the answer.
Yeah.
Sort of.
All right, we have a couple more, but I think we should wait for David to come back because it's more fun that way.
Oh, okay. Then let's just get on to listener mail.
Okay. First part of that is another listener story. And as I mentioned, we have quite a few that we've received. We're going to run through them in pretty much chronological order. And next up is one from Jesus Calderon, who actually sent in a email version of this, which I read several issues ago. But soon after that, he sent in his own recording. And actually, this is, even though it's the same story, it's in his own words, and I like his version a lot better. So,
and boy, if there's anybody that could tell us about the reasoning behind the massive terminal at the airport
in Madrid.
It would be him.
That's right,
even
yes.
Even though he's in Barcelona.
Well, he's listening, so you can tell us about that, too. So,
and tell us about the terminal when you get a chance. Okay.
All right, here's his story.
Hi, geeks. It's Jesus, your Catalan friend from Barcelona Tower. My first experience on taking the controls of an aircraft took place almost 13 years ago, in August 2000, when I was 17 years old, at the airport of Reus, about 10 kilometers from my home city, which is Tarragona. The aircraft was a little two-seater Cessna 152, and the instructor was Josep, or Joseph in English, who nowadays, more than a friend, he has become a brother. And no, there is no Mary in this story. After filling the flight plan and doing the walk around, always under Joseph's instructions, everything was set, so we attached ourselves to the cockpit seats, with me sitting on the left side. At that particular moment, I remember looking at the yoke in front of me, grabbing it with my two hands, and realizing that I was actually going to fly. Joseph guided me through all the checklist and procedures that he was actually executing. I started it up with the classic clear announcement, and taxied to the active runway. Once lined up, I pushed the throttle full forward, and when we reached 60 knots, Joseph told me the magic word, rotate. That was it. Nearly without knowing how or why, I realized I had just taken off and I was controlling the aircraft. What an unforgettable sensation. We spent the next hour flying over Tarragona city and the shoreline, doing some turns, and even flew through a white little cumulus cloud just to experience how frightening that is when you're not used to all the instruments. Finally, we came back to the airport. I lined up with the runway and prepared to land. While overflying the threshold at a few feet, Joseph told me to raise the nose and flare, but I misunderstood him and thought he was actually taking control for the touchdown, so I suddenly released the yoke. Almost instantaneously, Joseph jumped from his seat, grabbed the yoke with his two hands, and pulled it all he could, avoiding a nose-down crash into the runway. Thanks to his skills as a CFI, that was the beginning of my life in aviation and not the end, so I will always be in debt with him. And that's the way it was my baptism of flight. Thank you guys for all your hard work and hope to speak with you again soon. Deu.
All right. Thanks a lot for that. I'm really enjoying these, Rob.
Yeah, I really like that. I thought that was such a good story. And I think it is so I think it's so enlightening to people that don't fly that hear just how, I mean, I could hear the excitement in his voice when he was flying, even if, as if it was just happening. And I'm just sorry we didn't have a chance to meet him yet in person.
I know, not yet. We will someday. Maybe we will. All right, so we do have a number of these.
So next week, another one.
So next week, another one. And if for any listener who has a story to tell, make a little recording. It can be about your first flight, your first airline flight, the person who introduced you to aviation, the pilot who took you up for a ride, anything like that. Make it, if you can, brief. Try to be concise and maybe 3-4 minutes, something like that is a good target, and send that in to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. If you are having troubles with the recording technology available to you, just, you know, ask us too. We'll be glad to help you out. All right, let's move on to some listener mail. First, we heard from Jody. Jody Bromer was our guest in episode 235, and as you'll recall, she was getting ready to plan the events for the Institute for Women of Aviation Worldwide, and she writes to us and says that the event went great. She said there were a few girls who specifically came up to me after and said that until March 9th, when this was, they had never thought about aviation before. She says there were even more that had specific questions about certification and jobs and time and training. She says one young lady had dreams to be an airline pilot. Mission accomplished. So I think that's great. And, you know, Jody just made the story for, you know, several young girls that will probably, you know, embark one way or another in a interest or even a career in aviation. Someday they'll think back to what got them started and they'll think about Jody. I think that's very cool.
I do too. I just, and you know, that's probably the best part of this is I know we're doing it maybe one pilot at a time or three or six or eight or whatever. But imagine if everybody that flew had enough interest to try to find somebody that they could sort of take under their wing, even for a little while, to get them going. And I'm just really, not to mention the fact I'm really glad Jody passed her commercial ride.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So Jody's just hitting it on all cylinders these days, isn't she?
I think so, except that I tend to think in terms of turbine engines, so those aren't supposed to hit anything. They're supposed to be whining.
Okay. Next email, Brian sent in a link. He says, seems the folks at Philadelphia take the use of electronics seriously. And let's see, this is from a Philadelphia, the local CBS affiliate, Three on Your Side, thrown off United flight for taking photo. What? Well, this passenger took a photo of what he says was an empty seat on a United flight. The flight attendant comes up and says that this is against policy, and you're not allowed to take pictures of passengers without their permission, so forth and so on. Things sort of escalates. The guy gets thrown off the flight. And I don't know. It sounds like another one of those kind of overreaction on the part of the flight attendant.
I bet there's some piece of this that we're missing.
That could be.
I mean, to take a picture, I didn't realize there was anybody in the seat, but I doubt it seriously that there's some kind of a regulation on the airline that says you cannot take a picture in the airplane as long as it's not restricted in the time you're using the camera, but that says you cannot take a picture of something else that's going on in the airplane. I find that hard to believe. Look at all the videos we've seen over the years of things going on in the airplane. Now, maybe this was the flight attendant's boyfriend or girlfriend or something. Who knows?
Oh, okay, yeah.
So we better just leave that one.
Yeah, because, I mean, people do take pictures on airplanes all the time.
Oh, yeah.
You know, kids and tourists and people having a great time and pictures of their friends and
that's why I think there's probably more to this than we know about.
Could be. Yeah, that's often the case with these stories. So we'll put the link in the show notes, and you can take a look at that. It's a pretty entertaining. I think the guy ended up blogging about it as well, and the story kind of goes on and on. Let's see. Next, we heard from Ray. Ray writes in the latest podcast, which for him was episode 238. You talk about the London helicopter crash. Rob, that was one you talked about last week.
Correct.
The guy that in the bad weather conditions and the fog and so forth, right? He hit the crane and I guess killed himself and someone on the ground.
Yeah.
Ray said, I had known the weather was bad that day, but when listening to your talk, I hear guys familiar with piloting underlying how the copter pilot would have had his work cut out to deal with those conditions. Now, he sent a link to a Guardian report that says that the pilot was texting with both the passenger he was planning on picking up and also with his company's base. He says the times of the texts show that they were 6 or 7 minutes before the crash, which is, you know, it's a significant time. But given where he was and the prevailing conditions, Ray says, I think it would have been a distraction from the flying of the helicopter. I'm not saying it was a root cause, but it does suggest he was multitasking a bit.
Oh, yeah. It's funny. When I saw that, and the texting comment also came from the preliminary accident report that the Air Accidents Investigation Bureau, I want to get that right, the AAIB in the United Kingdom sent out. And I've always thought of helicopter pilots as being extremely busy anyway. When I've watched the flying, but then, you know, this is spoken as a fixed wing guy. But then to find out that somebody was not only flying the helicopter, but also managing to text at the same time. Wow. Hmm. I got to tell you, I'm impressed right up until he hit the crane.
I guess anytime you're doing something important, it's good to focus.
Well, and again, you know, as we talked about last week, we're not talking about just, you know, poor weather. I mean, it was really, really lousy weather. And so that's really the scary part of this whole thing. And I just can't imagine how this guy managed to control this thing at all in that kind of weather. And then have time to the ability to distract himself and text. But, hey, well.
Yeah. All right. We heard from Brian. Brian was driving past Teterboro Airport, and he saw a sign. And the sign says Aviation Hall of Fame. And he didn't have the time to stop. Teterboro, this is near Philadelphia. Is that right, Rob?
Teterboro Tower, this is Piper 202. Anyway, there used to be a song like that.
Really?
In fact, yeah, Teterboro is just across the Hudson from Manhattan, off the northwest corner of Manhattan. So it is the business aviation airport for much of New York.
Oh, I see. Have you ever been to the Aviation Hall of Fame?
I did not even know it existed until we got this message.
Yeah.
So and I have been there, I can't tell you how many times.
Yeah. You know, it seems like I go past that area from time to time. Maybe I should take a look at this and stop sometime. Check it out.
Yeah, well, it's probably worth it. As I said, I must admit, I didn't know it existed. Not that that means anything, but I'd never heard anybody talk about it.
Yeah.
So.
And as airplane geeks, this sounds like something that we should know all about.
Well, we should be geeky enough to understand this.
Yeah.
And but I guess there's always room for improvement.
Okay, let's see. Chris wrote in. Chris is in Tokyo, and he's an international high school student in Japan. He says he's writing to thank you for a great podcast. He recently listened to episode 236 with Henry Hartefelt, he says, and enjoyed his insight into the commercial aviation industry. He says, I'm interested in the airline industry and would love to have more guests or co-hosts that pertain directly to that field. Thinking about the following question, was wondering if it would be possible for him to answer the question. Now, he's looking at airlines operating the Boeing 757. And let's see if I can summarize this somehow.
No, I don't think you can, actually. I was trying to do the same thing, and I thought, there's no easy way to do this. There are many questions in one here.
There really are. And he's looking at the 737-9 and the Airbus A321, looking at the current United fleet of A319, A320 aircraft, has the infrastructure for that. He's asking, why didn't United choose the Airbus A321? He says it could be that the legacy Continental management, with its historical preference for Boeing aircraft, chose the 737-9 to continue that tradition. He says it could also be that purchasing the 737-9 was cheaper or gave United more say in its 787 delivery timeline. This guy, I think he knows a lot. I think he knows more than he's letting on here. He says, in my personal, admittedly slightly biased toward the A320 opinion, I would have thought aircraft operating costs and long-term fleet planning would come first, then a management choice to do business with a certain company. Considering all the points, what is your take? Not knowing the specifics, or being involved in the selection, you know, my general comment on something like this is that, you know, oftentimes in this industry, it's the commercial terms of the deal that trump everything else. So, yeah, while you would think that if you've got a fleet of, you know, certain aircraft and you're looking at expanding, it's you know, cheaper to continue on with the same aircraft because you've got that infrastructure, as Chris points out. But sometimes the competition will say, okay, let's value that, and then we'll reduce our price by that amount or a little bit more to sweeten the deal. So, and that's the commercial terms of the contract, of the deal. And there's a lot of that goes on.
But, of course, it could also be the fact Boeing was able to deliver 737s faster than Airbus could have delivered the alternative.
I mean,
the delivery time is a big important issue as well.
That can be.
However, yeah. I would like to, if we could just sort of, what is it they say, take a step back for just a moment. I don't want Chris's comment about the co-host to go unmentioned.
Okay.
Because he is very right in pointing out that since what's his name, the kid, left us in a lurch to go work for that airline. We've had a bit of a commercial airline hole in our show, and let it be known that we are trying to address that right now.
Yeah.
If we could, we'd hire Dan back from... Actually, that might work out better than we know pretty soon, but okay, I won't go down that road.
Well, we could get him fired, you know.
Yeah, well, that's right. You know what? Maybe we could start a write-in campaign.
Yeah, fire Dan.
Tell this company to get rid of the kid because his talents are better needed or better used somewhere else. But no, we're seriously looking at a commercial airline person that we can kind of use to fill in the gap, although there will never be another Dan.
No, of course not. Yeah, well, you know, we did pass this along to Henry Hartevelt, and we caught up with him. He was at the ITB Berlin, which is a travel trade show. And so I don't think he had a lot of time to answer, but he did write back, and he did say that he said, the airplanes may say United, but the management is all Continental. He says, I call it UNO. United in name only. And so he says Continental has been a Boeing-focused airline for a long time. And so that was probably what drove the decision to a large extent. So thanks, Chris. It was a great email, and we paraphrased a bit, but Chris had some really good information, some insight into what was going on here. He kind of reminded me of Dan a little bit.
Yeah, but...
But he's in Tokyo.
Had a sense of humor, didn't he?
How do you know?
No,
Chris
Dan
doesn't.
Didn't have a sense of humor either. That's right, because we used to pick on him all the time, relentlessly, and he kept coming back for more.
He sure did. He could pick right back.
Chris, could you do that?
We may have to find out.
Is that it? Are we done?
So that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. I want to thank everyone for listening. Yeah, we'd like to thank our guest, Bob Poole, founder of the Reason Foundation. You can find that at reason.org, and you can also see their video feeds at reason.tv. We want to thank our contributors, as always, Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast, those content creation machines. Those guys are just kind of amazing in that regard. We also want to thank Peter Johnson. Thanks him for his little mini-series there, and that's been really, really interesting. I think that's kind of cool to pick a topic and talk to, in this case, an airport, and talk to a number of different people associated with that and look at a lot of different aspects of that operation. It's been pretty interesting. So you can find Peter on Twitter at Nascot Hornet and also on Facebook at XTP Media. His podcast is aviation-extended.co.uk, no leading E on extended. All right, Rob, it's time to tell folks where they can find you online.
Well, don't you think we should start with where they can find Dan and call his boss and tell him that Dan's just not the kind of fellow they want to have working for them, and then, you know, we can give him something to do for a while.
I think we
can. Oh, well, maybe not.
All right.
Okay. They can find me at jetwine.com, Jetwine on Twitter, who knows how many other places on Facebook under various versions of my name. You just cannot find me on the walls at the post office. And, of course, for those of you outside the United States saying, what is he talking about? 20 years ago, they used to post wanted posters for bad guys in the post office on the wall. So,
so that's why you're not there any longer.
That's
huh?
why I'm not there, because they've
took that picture down.
What about you, Max? Where can they find you?
Well, you can find me on Google Plus and also Twitter is Max Flight. And you can also check out my 30,000feet.com aviation directory. You can find show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com. This is episode 239. Find lots of photos and links to the sites we mentioned on the show. Be sure to follow us on Twitter and Facebook, also Google Plus. Just look for Airplane Geeks. We also have a Google Plus community that's got some interesting content from our listeners. That's great. We're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream us right to your mobile phone. If you want to send us an email, the address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. That should be easy to remember. And we also have a listener line. And Benet Wilson has that number.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody. Thanks for listening.
All right. Well, since David's not here tonight, I was going to say not with us, and that sounded bad. Since David is not joining us this episode, we'll have to again defer on his history segment. But I don't know, Rob. We got to get him back next week.
Well, I don't know. I mean, do you think anybody cares? Okay. Oh, well, all right. Maybe they do.
All right. Yeah.
Okay, come on, we're going to do this at 6 o'clock and it's now 10:45. Let's go.
That's about normal timing for us.
Ah, the old routine.
Slapstick and sleepiness.
That's right.
I'm still the jealous Grant McHaren.
Ah, well. You'll get over it, buddy.
Yeah, only when I have a Super Hornet ride.
Mention that Hercules ride. Oh, fantastic.
Dude! Ow! Is this yours?